Going to introduce Mr. Dean Baker, who is the co-director for the Center of Economic and Policy Research at Washington, D.C. He's authored several books on the U.S. economy and on the financial system, and with a particularly interesting view on how the governance of the financial and banking system in the United States affects the average inhabitants and citizens of that country, and very much by extension, other parts of the world as well. Dr. Baker will be talking to us about the global financial crisis and how that crisis is turning now into a stage of planning or discussion about what reforms will be done, could be done, and will eventually happen or not. So, thank you.
Thank you. I appreciate the opportunity to come up here and speak to this group and on this panel. What I want to talk about is I'm going to focus my comments on financial transactions taxes, which is an area I've done a fair bit of work on over the years. And what I want to say first off a little bit about financial transactions taxes in the context of the current crisis. I'm not going to tell you that it would have prevented the crisis. I will say a little bit about how I think it may relate to the crisis, but I wouldn't be so bold as to claim if we'd had taxes in place, it would have prevented the crisis. Secondly, then, I want to talk a bit about the benefits. Why would we want financial transactions taxes lay out the case? And then thirdly, I'm going to talk a little bit about the report from the IMF that came out last week. They had at least a draft report that evaluated financial transactions taxes along with other taxes that are being considered on the financial sector. Okay, well, starting out, in terms of where our crisis came from, I'd say clearly a big part of that story is a bloated financial sector, and specifically, and here I'm being U.S.-centric, but I think some of this applies to a greater or lesser extent elsewhere in the world. We had an economy in the United States that was driven by financial bubbles ever since the mid-90s. So in the United States, we often talk about a virtuous circle in the decades immediately following World War II, where you had productivity growth that was translated fairly broadly into wage gains, which in turn were translated into consumption, which provided a basis for higher demand, increased investment, productivity growth, et cetera. That really breaks down in the 80s. Beginning in the 80s, partly because of policy, and again, this is a big debate to what extent was policy, what extent it was technology. I'm one of those who thinks it was largely policy, particularly weakening the power of unions. But in any case, what isn't in dispute is that it was no longer the case that most workers saw wage gains, that productivity gains were not broadly shared. They went disproportionately to those at the high end of the distribution, the wage distribution, and to some extent the redistribution to capital. So we no longer had this virtuous circle. And that created an environment in which there wasn't the same sort of pull towards investment. We had very weak investment in the United States in the late 80s, actually into the early 90s. So we had the economy go on a very different path. And when we began to actually see strong growth again in the late 90s, there was sort of a folk wisdom at the time that I think persists to some extent, probably more among the Democrats than the Republicans, but that was an investment boom. The real story of the late 90s was that was a consumption boom, that what was going on in the late 90s was that we had a huge run-up in the stock market, and that did not, it led to some increase in investment, but there's always been a very weak relationship between the stock market and investment. What it really did was stock wealth created on the order of $10 trillion of bubble wealth, and that led to a huge consumption boom. And it's easy to show that if you look at what was the area of GDP that was expanding in the late 90s, it was consumption, it wasn't investment. And anyhow, this was, I would say, promoted in part by the financial sector. I'll just say they prospered from it, that in the event you had not had such a vibrant, then probably not the best term, but such a bloated financial sector, you may not have seen that sort of bubble. They certainly profited from it. You may have seen more of a pressure to take a different path of growth. So, again, I'm not going to blame the financial sector for that story, but clearly they profited from it. They were certainly benefited enormously. And, again, because you had that path of growth, this bubble-driven growth, it prevented perhaps more pressure from pursuing alternative paths. We had, of course, our bubble collapsed, our stock bubble collapsed in 2000, 2001. We had the recession. We got out of that recession basically with the housing bubble. So we had this pattern of bubble-driven growth ever since the mid-90s. Again, the financial sector was front and center there. They prospered through it, and that obviously laid the basis for the crisis that we saw in 2008 and the downturn certainly that we're experiencing in a big way in the United States, but obviously throughout much of the world. Now, had we had a financial transaction tax, would none of this have happened? I don't think you could really say that. I think that would have reduced the size of the financial sector, slowed things down. Would that have prevented this path of growth? I think that would be, you know, kind of a strong claim. I think it certainly would have been a step in the right direction, but would that by itself, absent a lot of other moves, a lot of regulatory moves, would that have prevented this pattern of growth? I don't feel with any confidence I could say that. So I would simply say that, you know, the bubble-driven growth of the late 90s and the last decade was clearly unsustainable. It created the basis for the crisis that we're experiencing now. Had you had a smaller financial sector, more contained financial sector, you might have been able to prevent that. By itself, financial transaction tax probably would not have done that, although, again, as I would say, it certainly would have helped. Now, more generally, what would I say the arguments are for a tax? Well, four things. First and foremost, obviously, money. You could raise an awful lot of money, and I would say that with plausible tax rates, you could raise as much as 1% GDP through a financial transactions tax. Secondly, reducing the trading volume, the volume of trading in the financial sector, which I consider very much an end in itself. It makes the sector, the industry, more efficient. I'll come back to that. Thirdly, preventing short-term speculation, almost by definition. You're making that more costly. I mean, you're making any trading more costly, but it matters much more if you trade short-term than if you trade long-term. And lastly, just the flip side of that, if you make short-term speculation more costly, in principle, we should be giving a greater incentive towards long-term investment, which is, in principle, what we would want the financial sector to be focused on. Okay, well, going through those one by one, the amount of money that could be raised, again, it's simple enough to do the calculations. I and many others have done calculations, and naturally we recognize there'll be large reductions in trading volume. But in the case of the United States, where I've done most of this, but it's easy enough to apply it to the rest of the world, if you assume somewhere between 50 to 70% reductions in trading volume, you still would collect an amount of revenue that's somewhere in the neighborhood of 1% of GDP. Our financial sector has become so bloated that the volume of transactions exceeds GDP manyfold. And even if, you know, again, even assuming large reductions in trading volume, which is to a large extent the point, of course, of the tax, you still end up with very substantial amounts of revenue. And this really isn't something that should be that heavily debated. I mean, where we put the deficit, you know, where exactly we end up with the exact number might be debated. But the fact you could get large amounts of revenue this way isn't really a debatable proposition because it has been done. England, the UK, has in place a transactions tax. I've actually been trying to find out how far back it goes. I saw a reference to 1694. Now, I'm not sure it's been continuous since then, but they've had a tax in place for many, many decades. They lowered it in the mid-80s to half of 1% on a stock trade. It used to be 1%. But they still collect an amount equal to roughly 0.3% of GDP, and that's just taxing stock trades. So they're not taxing trades of bonds, options, futures, any other derivative instruments. And I should also say, I don't think it's a secret that the UK hasn't been that anxious to enforce it. So insofar as people have found ways to evade it or avoid it, the government has not been as vigilant as it could be in trying to enforce it. And they still get an amount of revenue equal to about 0.3% of GDP. So that's a fairly substantial amount of revenue from a tax that's fairly narrowly applied. As another example, Japan, until the early 90s, had a broad range of financial transactions taxes on stocks, options, futures, most trades, not all, but most trades. And they raised an amount that was equal to about 0.8% of GDP. They got about 4% of their government revenue through the tax. So the idea that this is somehow, you know, we can't get a lot of money this way, clearly we can. Whether it's desirable or not, we could argue. But the fact that we could raise substantial amounts of revenue through these sorts of taxes, clearly it's the case. Okay, a second point, reducing trading volume. I consider this important because, again, just thinking why do we have the financial industry, I'm not making value judgments here, just, you know, what does it do for the economy? Well, the whole point is it takes money from people who want to save and transfer it to those who want to invest, to borrow for a home or education, whatever it might be. That's its purpose. And in principle, you want it to be as small as possible. It's an intermediate good. I mean, that's the point. And the analogy I often make, it's like the trucking industry. And what's happened, this trucking industry has quintupled relative to the size of the economy. So if you look back to the 70s, and I'm sorry, I'm referring to the U.S., not Canada, but I suspect something comparable here, if not the exact same magnitudes. In the United States, in the 70s, the financial sector was equal to about 0.5% of private sector GDP. More recently, it's more than 2.5% of private sector GDP. So we've had a quintuple relative to the size of GDP, and the obvious question is, well, what are we getting for that? Do we think that capital is somehow allocated better, you know, today, 2010, 2007, during the housing bubble? Was it somehow better allocated than it had been back in the 50s, 60s, and 70s? Are we more secure in our savings? You know, what are we getting for that, you know, for this huge growth in that sector? And I think you'd be hard-pressed to identify what exactly you're getting for that. So in that context, if you could reduce the size of the sector, reduce the volume of trading without impeding its ability to function, its ability to transfer money from savers to those who want to invest, to those who want to borrow, that's a pure gain for the economy. So if we could snap our fingers and reduce the size of the trucking sector by 50% and still get all the goods from point A to point B at the same time, why wouldn't we do that? So if through a financial transactions tax we could reduce the resources used by the financial sector, to my mind that's a pure gain. And obviously I should also point out, and again this is U.S. story, but I'm sure at least to some extent a Canadian story and a story elsewhere, you have a very bloated salary structure, and it doesn't bother me that you might be whittling away some of the high-end incomes. These are rents in my view. So that again is a side benefit. The third motivation, preventing speculation, again, here's just sort of a straight logical point. The return you expect to get on a trade where you're buying at 1 o'clock and selling at 2 o'clock is considerably less than what you might expect to get if your trade, you know, you're buying something this year and you expect to hold the asset for 5 years or 10 years. A trade that you buy at 1 o'clock and you sell at 2, if you made a 1% profit, that would be very good. On the other hand, if you're taxing that, even a very modest tax will make that a much more risky proposition. You'll be much less likely to do that. So it almost by definition has to reduce a lot of the short-term trading. Now, what does that do for volatility? Well, one of the things that anyone would rightly point out, it will reduce arbitrage as well, because you could have a greater divergence. Let's imagine we know the true price of a product, oil or whatever it might be. We somehow know the true price. Well, you could have a greater divergence from that true price before it becomes profitable to step into that market and arbitrage that away. To my mind, that's a relatively little consequence. I mean, if we have the price of oil vary by, you know, 0.125% more because we have this tax in the market that discourages some arbitrage, I see very low cost to that. I'd be willing to live with that. On the other hand, there's an alternative perspective. There's a literature, Larry Summers is actually one of the leading writers in this. I like to pick on him for this because I don't think he'd endorse it today, but he did some very good work on this 2 decades ago. There's this literature, Noise Trader, where you have traders that trade on momentum. They see that the price of oil is going up, therefore they buy oil. They couldn't care less what the fundamentals of the oil market are. They're making a bet that the price of oil rose yesterday, it rose this morning, it's going to rise through the rest of the day, and they're going to dump it before it turns around. And that could lead to divergences from fundamentals. So if you have a lot of noise traders in the market who are looking to trade purely on short-term movements, then that can lead to divergences, can lead to bubbles. And I would argue that at least at certain times you could have that effect. You could weaken that effect, I should say, by raising the cost of these transactions. You're making it more costly to engage in this sort of noise trading. You're making a higher risk proposition. And at least at times, that may have the effect of reducing volatility in markets. And again, it's the sort of volatility that I worry about. I care less that oil, you know, went up 0.5% today and it's going to go down 0.5% tomorrow when actually nothing happened in the world, than the case where we have oil go up 30% or 40% and then it collapses. So is this going to prevent all bubbles? No. Might it prevent some bubbles? I would say it might. Won't make a strong argument that way, but it at least might. The last point, again, just the flip side of that, if you make short-term speculation less profitable, we get people to focus on what, in my view, we want them to focus on. What do the fundamentals tell us? Where's a good place to invest for the long term? To my mind, that has to lead to better outcomes. And again, that's just definitional. You've taken some of the profits out of short-term investing. Where are you going to get your profits? It has to be by long term. Okay, well, just quickly, the IMF report came out last week, and they were asked to look at this. Obviously, many governments have expressed interest in financial transactions tax, and that was the reason why the IMF looked in that. And they made several, to my mind, interesting points. First off, one of the disputes, I think it was sort of a silly dispute, but one of the disputes was whether it was even feasible. And the report said quite ambiguously that it was. I mean, I thought it was a silly dispute because you have the UK there collecting a lot of money. So obviously it seems to me it's feasible, you know, unless they're mismeasuring what the revenue they collect in the UK. So it seemed to me pretty evident it was feasible, but, you know, it's good to have the IMF in agreement on that. They raised some downsides to it. They said that it would raise the cost of capital, and they cited some studies that have shown estimates anywhere between 10 basis points and 150 basis points. And the other point they said is that it will be somewhat indiscriminate, that many of the trades you're taxing, you probably don't want to tax. These are both valid points, that it will raise the cost of capital. Obviously, it will to some extent. There's a big range. If you say 10 basis points, that's probably pretty invisible for most purposes. 150 is certainly more visible. The other point I would say about that is that that's a assumption taking the tax in isolation, just taking the direct effect. The indirect effect, of course, is that you're reducing budget deficits, other things equal. I mean, we have to ask what we use the money for, but if you just the immediate response, you're raising more revenue, you reduce the budget deficit, that would lower the cost of capital. So if you take a full analysis, it's not clear what direction it takes the cost of capital. If we use some of it for reducing budget deficits, we use some of it for other purposes, it could leave the cost of capital pretty much unaffected, but there's no a priori reason to assume it'll lead to a large increase in the cost of capital. In terms of the transactions, again, obviously you will be taxing some transactions that you would rather not. I mean, I don't particularly want to make it more expensive for someone to take out a mortgage on their home. I don't think that's something we really want to do particularly, but it would make that at least to some extent more expensive. Now, how you structure it will determine how much impact it has, but almost certainly, you know, if you say what's the direction of change there, it almost certainly has to be positive. The other side, though, they came up with this idea of a financial activities tax, essentially a value-added tax on the financial sector, which is intended to accomplish many the same purposes as a financial transactions tax. So the point here is, again, it could raise a lot of money. I think they were talking about rates on the order of 15 or 20%. I probably would put it about twice that level, but regardless, I mean, the point's the same. It could raise a substantial amount of money. And secondly, the idea is that we reduce the volume of trading in the financial sector with the idea that there's rents there that we want to eliminate or at least reduce. I think it's an interesting proposal. I think the points, though, we just have to ask when you look at that and compare financial transactions taxes, you know, which is doing better in terms of, you know, taxing what you want to tax and not taxing the aspects of the financial sector that you think are good. They made a point of saying the financial transactions tax would increase the cost of capital. Certainly, their financial activities tax would also increase the cost of capital. So what's the relative impact? Well, you'd have to boil that down, look at the exact specifics of the structure. But a priori, there's no basis for saying that one will raise the cost of capital more than the other. So I don't know that gives you a reason to decide one's good or one's bad. The second point, again, just as with the financial transactions tax, a financial activities tax would also tax transactions that we don't particularly want to tax. So again, financial activities tax will make it more expensive for someone to take out a mortgage or a student loan. So, you know, what I would just say about this is that it's an interesting proposal. I'm very glad to see that the IMF is thinking along these lines in the sense they're saying, you know, can we raise money from the financial sector? Can we reduce the volume of trading, volume of rents in the financial sector? It's very good that they're thinking along these lines. I'm still inclined to think that the transactions tax is probably a better route to go simply because I think by its nature you will more closely target the sort of transactions you do want to reduce or eliminate. You will more closely target the sort of short-term trading. But, you know, that's not it's something I think we have to look at the evidence, you know, sit down and try and parse these out more closely, look at specifics and see which comes out better. But I think the basic point, I hope we're moving towards agreement on this, is that we want to have more taxes coming from the financial sector. We want to reduce the volume of trading, volume of activity, and I think that's a very positive direction. So I'll just conclude with that, and, you know, I hope I look forward to a good discussion.